You're listening to Crown and Crozier, the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship, and I'm your host, Patrick Brown. Does protecting kids mean we have to turn priests into government informants? It might sound like a far-fetched question, but during their recent legislative sessions, a few U.S. state legislatures found themselves wrestling with this exact question. Under the guise of seeking to strengthen measures to safeguard children, several legislative proposals would have required priests to violate the seal of confession if information regarding incidents of abuse came to their attention in the confessional. Joining us to discuss the profound implications of these bills is someone who had a front row seat during the debates in the state legislatures, which were recently examining this issue. Eric Niffen is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and has been an attorney focused on religious liberty for almost 20 years. He worked in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice under the George W. Bush administration. In private practice, Eric has defended hundreds of religious employers from federal mandates regarding contraception, abortifacients, and gender transition. Before we dive into the conversation, don't forget to subscribe to Crown and Crozier wherever you get your podcasts, and thank you so much for listening in.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, but God's first.
Eric Niffen, welcome to Crown and Crozier. Great to have you.
Thanks so much, Patrick. Good to be with you.
For today's discussion, we're going to talk about some very intriguing legislative proposals, which several U.S. states were looking at during the most recent legislative session. And what all these proposals had in common, among other things, is that they would have had grave consequences for the sacrament and the seal of confession. So in today's conversation, really looking forward to getting a better understanding of, you know, what was the genesis for these bills? Where did this all come from? What were the issues at play? What does this all mean, particularly for the sacredness of the sacrament of reconciliation? And where is this all going? So if perhaps just to kick us off, maybe just give us a sense, you know, which U.S. states were considering these measures? What were their measures and what were their general scopes and objectives?
Sure. This most recent push of states trying to pass these bills came in the wake of an Associated Press report that came out last fall that was framing this issue as if the priest penitent privilege is this loophole, this singular exception to efforts to protect children from sexual abuse. And framing it that way, I think, had a lot of, it generated a lot of local news reports, which led to these bills. The most significant bills that I saw were in Kansas and in Utah, where they didn't get anywhere. And then there were three other states where they had some purchase: Vermont, Delaware, and then Washington State. And the general scope and the provision of these bills were the same. So all 50 states have mandatory reporter laws. So those laws generally say that in some circumstances, and sometimes it's some people, designated professions, sometimes it's all people, but that when whoever it is a mandatory reporter has a reasonable suspicion that a child has been abused or neglected, they must report to the civil authorities. So all 50 states have such laws. And all 50 states also recognize, to some extent, the priest-penitent privilege, which says sometimes it's in court, sometimes it's just a general statement that says that the confidentiality of the priest-penitent relationship is recognized, just like an attorney-client relationship or a doctor-patient relationship. And so all 50 states have both of these laws, but then the question is, what happens when they intersect? And so these bills would each have explicitly said that priests must report on suspected child abuse, even if the only information they receive is from a protected, an otherwise protected confidential communication.
So I just want to understand a little bit better that AP, that Associated Press report that you referenced from the fall of 2022. I mean, what were they latching onto? Was there some driver or event or development which caught the attention of the AP. Like, what was your sense of what motivated them at that time to issue that report?
There was nothing in particular that sparked the report. The report is written as though there was something new that had happened or there's some new awareness. And perhaps that it was new to the reporter. But this has been a longstanding set of laws. There have been dozens of such bills that have been proposed since the church's sexual abuse crisis began in 2002. Interestingly enough, while there are some laws that we can get into, there are some laws that predate 2002 that appear, whether intentionally or not, to override the priest penitent privilege. Every single bill that's been proposed since 2002 has been defeated. And so there's nothing new about this. So I don't know what led to the AP report, but there was nothing in the news that should have made this seem like something new, but it was reported that way. And that led to a lot of emotion and a lot of activity in state legislatures.
So for the three measures which did get some traction in the legislative process, as you say, in Washington, Delaware, and Vermont, I mean, it sounds like they were all largely similar in terms of their scope, i.e. imposing this reporting obligation on priests, including for purposes of information that came to their attention during the sacrament of confession. So under the scope of these bills, what were the implications if a priest failed to undertake such reporting?
That's a good question. I don't know offhand. I can't recall that. Some sort of civil penalties. And this is the case in general, that if you have information you failed to report, there's probably some civil penalty that follows. The penalty itself is not really the issue. It's not that there's a certain fine that priests are unwilling to pay. It's really more about the public signal that such a law puts out there for the public in terms of the relationships between religious liberty and public safety, and then also really importantly to the Catholic faithful as well. For them, as Catholics, the notion that when you go into the confessional, this is an absolutely safe place for you to unburden your soul. It's hard enough to go to confession as it is. But if there is any area in which the state can lean on the church and get priests to reveal something, then that is a crack that signifies a really fundamental change in that relationship. A lot of the pushback that would come from legislators saying, why is it that priests want to hide sex abusers? Mm-hmm. And that's not the issue. The issue is whether or not this is a sacred, confidential space for people to unburden their souls. And either it is or it isn't. And these bills, among other things, were saying that the state has the right to determine when these sorts of religious relationships are confidential.
So again, just for clarification, in each of those three states, Washington, Delaware, and Vermont, it was on the table for information received under the seal of confession to be subject to mandatory reporting. That was a unifying thread across all three?
Correct.
What was your sense of the reaction from the sponsors or the supporters of the measures when it was brought to their attention? Look, this constitutes a significant violation and trespass upon a fundamental sacramental understanding and practice within the Catholic faith. I mean, was it met with a shrug of the shoulders, or, okay, we hadn't considered that, tell me more, or somewhere else on the spectrum? Like, what was the response?
It's hard to tell because as someone advocating against these bills, I don't get a direct response from legislators in terms of what they're thinking and why they do or don't do something. But from my position, the bill in Delaware, after I submitted public comment and after the bishop spoke up, the bill went away quietly. Mm. So some combination, it seemed there that some pushback was enough to say, okay, let's just park this. In Vermont, there was a little bit more activity. I participated, and Bishop of Vermont participated in some public hearings. And at the end of the hearing, the sponsoring senator looked to his legislative aide and said, maybe we haven't really thought this through. Mm. So I think we succeeded there in bringing some issues to the fore that they recognized then that this issue was more complicated than they'd thought. in Washington State, there was a lot more interest in the bill. It did get through one house. And I and others had more opportunity to speak to why this bill was unnecessary and a bad idea. I was disappointed to see that many of the legislators I spoke with were simply unmoved by the arguments against the bill. The discriminatory nature of the bill, the fact that it would not accomplish anything. And so I don't know how to read behind that in terms of what their motives were, whether they thought I was bluffing. But there was a lot of push right up till very close to the deadline of the legislative session to try to get this through. Fortunately, it failed right there at the end.
So let's speak a little bit more to those arguments that you made in your submissions to the respective committees and legislatures. It seems to me that your key arguments kind of broke down along three or four lines. And you hinted at that a little bit just now in terms of the discriminatory nature, their impracticality. Could you speak a little bit more to the core arguments that you were advancing?
Let's speak with some of the practical aspects. I think really important, and this is a message for legislatures, but perhaps even more importantly for Catholics, is say that the priests have your back, and that this is something that one canon lawyer I spoke with said this really well. He said, you know, there's a wide variety among Catholic priests on a huge range of issues, but one thing that unites them is this core deep conviction that priests do not violate this trust that's putting them in the confessional, and that priests and bishops are able to say with a great deal of confidence, priests will not obey this law. And so that is to say to the legislatures, you can try, but you will not succeed in making priests into government informants. And you will make them into martyrs if you try. You could do that, but you will not succeed in getting them to reveal to you what people say in the confessional. So that's something that needs to be said really clearly to legislatures, and then also really clearly to Catholics, is that no matter what the state tries to do, they will not succeed. This will continue to be a safe place for you to unburden your soul before God. So that's a really important practical point there.
One thing that really struck me from some of the submissions you made and some of the articles published in First Things and other outlets where you were summarizing your submissions was the emphasis on a violation by a priest of the seal of confession automatically entails the punishment of excommunication. And I'll admit I was ignorant to that fact, but among other things, that just speaks to how salvation is on the line under these measures. Can you reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah, canon law and the church's history are really clear on this. The I'm not a Latinist, but the code uses the word nephas, which cannot come over, I'm told, into English clearly enough, that the word is not never. So the translation in the code is never, but it's more like no way, never, no how, absolutely unacceptable. So never doesn't even quite capture when the code says a priest may never do this. And I think it's also really interesting that the penalties for this, the automatic excommunication, as you mentioned, and then also this is an excommunication that can only be relieved by the Pope. The Code of Canon Law puts this in a special category of crimes alongside physically assaulting the Pope. The Code does everything it can to say this is a really, really big deal. And so that's something for priests, obviously, but it's also something for Catholics to know as well, that the church takes this really, really seriously. I also like being able to share stories of Catholic saints who have priests who have been martyred because they stood up for this right of people to go to confession confidentially. There's a lot of states that a lot of situations where priests were standing up to military dictators. But my favorite is St. John Nepomucene, who is a Czech priest in the 14th century. And he was a great priest, a great preacher, and became the official confessor to the royal court. And the king got jealous and knew that his wife, the queen, was confessing to the priest, and dragged him in and says, I want you to tell me what my wife confessed to you. Is she having an affair? And the priest just laughed and says, I can't tell you that. And he got leaned on. And the king said, I'm going to torture you if you don't tell me. And he says, well, you got to do what you got to do, but I'm not going to tell you. And he did get killed. And his body was thrown out into the river. And the people immediately rallied around and saw this priest as a hero. I think that story really speaks to me because it illustrates really well the fact that this privilege, this privacy, is there not to protect priests. It's not there to protect the church. It's there to protect people. And the common people there in the Czech Republic understood that. They said, this guy stood up for us against a bully king. And something similar is happening whenever government tries to invade religious liberty, and that this is something that's there for the people. And it's a beautiful thing when priests and the church stand up for our civil liberties.
It seems to me like that angle is one side of the practicality rebuttal, i.e. these measures aren't practical because the priests simply cannot comply by virtue of their station, by virtue of their vocation, their office. They can't comply with this. They simply cannot violate the seal of confession. It seems to me there's another side of the coin around practicality as it relates to the benefits that these measures would have. And I think you mentioned that in your comments as well. These measures will have no practical benefit because they're not a solution to the problem at hand, namely ensuring the safety of children. So could you speak to that a little bit more about how the practical benefits of these measures simply fall short?
Right. So what I've said so far is to say that even if priests had heard such information, they wouldn't report it to civil authorities. But the next step is to say that there's nothing really to report. There's absolutely no evidence to out there that would suggest that there are things that should be reported under these proposed laws. There's no case in all three of these states, in all three of these states, the state presented no evidence that the seal of confession had caused or perpetuated child abuse. I have in my work on this and other issues with dioceses for years, I've studied each of the grand jury reports and each of the attorney general reports that have come out in the past 20 years about Catholic abuse crisis, the Pennsylvania report that came out a few years ago. There was an Illinois one that came out, thousands and thousands of pages. And in none of these have I seen a single instance in which the seal of the confessional was something that impeded civil authorities from finding out about abuse. In many of these reports, the attorney general or the grand jury lists specific recommendations. Here's what we think ought to be done going forward. In none of those has the seal of the confessional been identified as a problem. Mm. So that's really important. Also, as part of this, it is, I think, helpful to recognize, and I've tried to communicate this to legislatures, that this conventional wisdom, which is laid out there, that says everyone knows the Catholic Church has a huge problem with sex abuse. That's laid out there very confidently, but the facts really otherwise. The USCCB has committed itself to a process whereby an independent auditor each year analyzes information and produces a report on how the church is doing. And by all accounts, the sexual abuse crisis was a huge problem for a long time. But since the year 2000, there have been virtually no new cases from that time frame, which is to say the new reports that come in are almost completely somewhere around the level of 98%, 99% about incidences that happened in the 1980s, in the 1970s, in the 1960s. And so that even the new reports that come out are about things that happened a long time ago. And the Catholic Church has gotten a lot of credit from some unlikely allies, about people who have recognized, you know, the Catholic Church has really done a good job in this area. They've been held out as a model for other big institutions in our society, for the Olympic sports, for the Boy Scouts, for other churches, that the Catholic Church has done a good job in this regard. So that there isn't a lot of information out there that to support the notion that Catholic priests are abusing children. There is no evidence out there that the Catholic practice of keeping confessions confidential is impeding law enforcement in this area. And then more practically, if one of these bills was to pass, and so the newspapers say, Sex abusers who confess to Catholic priests, that's no longer a safe space for you. If there were people who are abusing children and who are Catholic and who are conscientious enough to go confess their sins to a priest, certainly it would seem that a headline like this, a new law being passed, would impede them. So another practical reason that we've laid out before legislators to say, I don't think you've thought this through. And so there's just a wide variety of practical reasons to think that these sorts of bills are not aimed, are not fine-tuned at capturing an actual problem.
Yeah, and among the other considerations to throw into the mix, it seems entirely plausible that if an abuser were to disclose an instance of abuse during confession, it's quite possible that that would be done anonymously. I think of the many times I've been in a confessional, I usually don't mention my name. One could see that being the practice or the case for someone who's confessing a grave crime or a sin like sexual abuse. So I'm curious, you know, that consideration, anonymous reporting, was that discussed at all in the context of these measures? And was it also discussed at these committees, if something like this would come to a priest's attention, the priest would take some kind of action? It's not like it would just wash off his shoulder like water off a duck. I mean, the priest would do something. So those two considerations as well, did those get any airtime in these discussions?
Yes, thanks for mentioning those both. So there is a canonical right in the Catholic Church for everyone to go to confession anonymously. And so there are face-to-face confessionals, but you know, even then, priests don't say, would you please give me your name and address? But the number one reason why we are able to go to confession anonymously is to make it easier for us to go to unburden ourselves, that if doing it behind a screen helps us get over our shame and voice these things that we've done, if that's easier, the church makes that available to us. And then the second point that you mentioned.
The priest would take some kind of action if he heard something.
Oh, yes. Yes. Thank you. This is something that priests have testified to really effectively, I think. It is important on a human level for I and others, and priests can do it more effectively than me, priests and bishops, to be able to communicate, look, the Catholic Church cares about child abuse. The Catholic Church wants justice. And to explain what it is that priests cannot do, but also what they can do in these circumstances. And priests generally, when they do come across information in the context of a confession where, let's say, a woman says her husband is abusing her, if someone has committed a crime, if someone is really poor and in need of some assistance, and also in the case of sexual abuse. There's a range of these sorts of issues where a priest might say, I really want to help you with this. I want to connect you with some services. Let's go to the police together. But in order to do that, you need to meet with me outside of the confessional so I can talk to you about this in a different context. And so inside the confessional, the priest has the purple stole on. There's only certain things he can do. He absolutely cannot take that information outside of the confessional. So what a priest will do, he might say, as soon as we're done with our confession, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get up and I'm going to go into the hallway, or I'm going to get up and I'm going to go to my office. It is your choice. You can go through door number one or you can go through door number two, but I urge you, please come talk to me so that we can talk about this issue in a different context so I can help you. And so that could be for someone who has been sexually abused, and that could be for an abuser. You know, for the priest to say, and if you are truly penitent about this sin, you need to make some restitution. I'd like to meet with you outside of the confessional and walk alongside you through that process. And then in that context, in every other context, priests are happy to be mandatory reporters and believe they should be. That's one thing that we emphasized in Washington State. In most states, clergy, not just priests, but all clergy are mandatory reporters. But in some, they're not. And in Washington State, right now, they're not. And we were able to say to the legislature, look, Catholic priests are already mandatory reporters by diocesan policy in all three Washington dioceses. We're already there. We believe we should be mandatory porters, and we treat ourselves that way for diocesan purposes. And the only exception is inside the confessional. And so, you know, priests do want to be part of the solution in this. I think that's something that's really been drilled in over the past 20 years. It has been helpful to message that to legislatures to say, look, clergy will do everything they can. They are not trying to use this in order to impede law enforcement. That goal is not to get information. And so priests will try to invite people to give priests the opportunity to help them in practical ways, including reporting information to civil authorities. But that effort to want to help people cannot be allowed to call into question the confidentiality of what happens in the confessional.
There were one or two themes there that I want to revisit towards the end of our conversation in terms of where this goes next and what tactics the sponsors and supporters of these measures might take to try and move these things to the finish line. But I do want to make sure we give some airtime to kind of the last basket of core arguments that you were making in these legislative processes. We've talked about their practical limitations in terms of these measures, but you also argue that they were discriminatory. Can you speak to that a little bit more?
What we've talked about so far generally has concerned my efforts to explain to legislatures the practical aspects of these laws. And all of those are relevant to the legal arguments. And so under the First Amendment here in the United States, the key legal framework here is the free exercise of religion. The Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment broadly says that government, both state and federal government, cannot impede the free exercise of religion. And that is understood to mean that a law that treats religious practice with less respect or with more restrictions than comparable secular activity is subject to the highest level of scrutiny called strict scrutiny. And so where I began with legislatures in this and where I would begin making a legal argument against one of these bills were it to become law is to say that traditionally in the Anglo-American context, there are two privileges that are held as most sacrosanct. And one is a secular privilege, that between an attorney and a client, and then there's a religious privilege between clergy and a penitent. So what these bills were doing is all three of them were very clear that they were going to pierce the religious privilege, but to leave the secular privilege intact, which is to say that under these bills, someone who abuses a child has a legal right to a confidential communication with his lawyer, but not with a confidential communication with his priest. And that is a clear case of religious discrimination. To go back to cases for 200 years in the United States, the New York Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, in Washington State, we were looking at the Ninth Circuit Appellate Court, that have recognized that these privileges go together and they're both sacrosanct. And so that is to point out for two reasons. First of all, it shows that these laws are unequal. They are treating religious activity unequally. And second, it is to show that these laws are not necessary in order to achieve the state's objectives. So if you get into the strict scrutiny analysis, one of the things you say is, is there evidence that the government is, that this is not as important to the government as it may claim? And one of the ways you see that is, well, if the government thinks that it can accomplish its goals while continuing to have an exemption for secular activity that is similar in nature, then perhaps this objective is not as important as the government's letting on. Which is to say, again, if the government was really serious, it would say across the board, fighting child sex abuse is more important than anything. But our response is, except for the attorney-client privilege. Right. So it's not true that across the board, this is the government's highest priority. It recognizes something as continuing to be important. And it's important to realize, because that it is a hard thing to wrap your mind around. It's like, okay, well, here's something that would help a child. Here's something that would bring a criminal to justice, but we're not going to go there. But this is something, it's important to note, that we do in a lot of different areas. So a big thing in the, there's the attorney-client privilege. And so if you're representing a client, it's important for attorney to know, look, if you did this, I got to know, because if I get into court and something comes up, I don't want to be flat-footed. I have to know everything before I go in there so I can represent you well. And we allow the attorney to hold out of that information. Another example is the Fourth Amendment, talking about searches and seizures, that if priests violate someone's rights, if they enter a home without a warrant, the remedy there is to have that evidence suppressed, even if that evidence shows guilt. One of the cases that I like to bring up for the Washington State was a Ninth Circuit case involving a prisoner whose confession to a priest was accidentally or intentionally recorded by the prison authorities. So the prison recorded all conversations as a matter of course, except for attorney-client privileges. They just had that in their list. And whether they knew this person was going to confess or not, they left the recording light on. And so they had this confession, and this person was up on a murder charge. And what was really interesting here is it was the priest that found out about this recording and brought suit. So it wasn't the prisoner, but the priest himself. And he says, this invades my rights as a Catholic priest. This violates my free exercise of religion. And then the bishop at the time, who later became Cardinal George of Chicago, also intervened. And he said, this affects my rights too. I can't carry out my ministry to the people in my diocese within this state if I can't guarantee them that the free exercise, that they can go to confession confidentially. And the Ninth Circuit upheld that.
Wow.
And so that was an important affirmation that, yes, our civil liberties are so important that they take precedent over the truth-finding function of our court system.
Right.
So what we're asking for in this context is not the only time this happens. This happens generally in the Fourth Amendment context with searches and seizures. This happens in the attorney-client privilege. And so one of the things that this loophole language that we mentioned at the beginning with the attorney, the Associated Press piece, it made it seem as though this is a singular example of the church getting something that no one else gets. And part of the rhetorical and the legal argument here is to say it's actually not. That there are things that in our legal system, we recognize that privacy, that civil society, that there are certain sorts of things. A spousal privilege relationship, that if you confess a crime to your spouse, they cannot be forced to testify against you. And so we do have these principles within our law. And so to explain that legally, that what the state is trying to do here invades on a privilege that is long established, and that is held, has been held for a long time to be just as sacrosanct as the attorney-client privilege. And so to attack the one, the religious one, and to leave the other one in place is discriminatory and unconstitutional. It is to say that it's good for lawyers to keep confession secret for secular reasons, but it's illegal for priests to keep confession secret for religious reasons. And as I tried to argue throughout my testimony, that is unfair, and it's unjust, and it's unconstitutional.
Another example that I thought might get included either in your remarks here during our conversation, or I don't know if you touched upon it in your submissions, but I thought you might go as well in the direction of doctor-patient privilege. I mean, is that something that enjoys legal protection, or is that more social convention? Does it rise to the same level as attorney-client?
It does have legal protection. It's not, it's a little more nuanced than the attorney-client privilege. And so I haven't emphasized that in my arguments. It's not as parallel. The doctor-patient relationship, it's a little bit narrower. It pertains generally to information that's necessary for diagnosing.
Mm.
And so it's a little bit more like if the priest penitent privilege, if you can imagine a priest, because when we all go into confession, there's a lot of sort of, there's often narrative that sort of leads up to the confession. So it's, well, I was out with my husband and no.
Right.
And then this happened. And so a priest might be put in a position to say, well, the confession itself I'll hold privileged, but the story that came before that is not subject to the privilege. The Catholic Church has made it really, really simple for priests and for penitents by saying, nope, we're just going to say everything that happens inside the box is covered by that. And so the, you know, there's some other exceptions to the patient, doctor patient privilege. If someone if there's imminent harm involved, and there's some other exceptions. And so it's a little bit more nuanced. And so I haven't leaned on that one in the same way.
Okay. Now that's a very helpful clarification. So it seems to me, getting back to your core arguments and how they break down, the impractical nature of these bills, their discriminatory nature, and their unconstitutionality. And it seems to me that the kind of the discriminatory part bleeds into the criticism around their unconstitutional nature. Under the hypothetical scenario, if one of these bills advances, whether from Vermont, Delaware, or Washington, can take your money to the bank, that they're going to be constitutional challenges and litigation. So is it on that discriminatory angle where you see the greatest exposure or vulnerability from a constitutional perspective when it comes to these bills?
Yes, that's right. Religious liberty generally is not unqualified. And so, you know, if you went to church, you know, if you went into prayer and you're priest told you in a homily, or you had a vision from God that said, God wants me to drive 100 miles an hour backwards down the highway on the way home from church, and a cop pulled you over, or you ended up in a ditch and then a cop came in and came to arrest you, your response saying, but God wanted me to do this, or I sincerely believe that God wanted me to do this, would not save you. And so our religious liberty is not unqualified. And certainly where our religious liberty comes up into harming others, you know, if you had a vision that God wanted you to kill a number of people, the fact that you had a religious motive would not save you. And it's important for me to explain this to legislatures too, is no one is saying, I'm certainly not saying that the right to religious liberty is unqualified. And so when I'm making an argument to legislatures, and when I would be making an argument to a court, it's not enough to simply say this law would burden religious exercise.
Mm-hmm.
That's not enough. And so to show that the law is discriminatory is important legally, because at first it shows that the government is treating religion unequally. It's targeting a certain type of religious activity when it's not targeting comparable secular activity. And so the law itself is not neutral. And also, as I mentioned, the same information is also relevant to show that the government, that this goal the government has is not as important as the government says it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not attacking this problem, identified problem across the board. It's really important to me in my conversations, particularly in Washington State, to put my cards on the table. And I don't know how they understood this, but I was as frank as I could be. And I said, look, I've tried to explain to you a lot of different reasons why this law would not accomplish what you think it's going to accomplish. But now let me give you one more. If you pass this into law, a lawsuit will be filed very, very quickly. We will go to court. This law will be enjoined. It will never go into effect. These are the arguments I would make. This is why I'm going to win. You are not going to accomplish anything. So that even if you pass it into law, set aside all the other practical arguments we've made, I have a high degree of confidence that litigation would be successful in blocking this law before it ever went into effect. And so you'd end up creating good case law for religious liberty lawyers towards no good positive end for the people of Washington State or any other state that would try this.
And how is that received?
It's hard to know. Again, it's hard to know what arguments were getting through, what arguments were effective. I think some people might have thought that I was bluffing, but those arguments, I heard them echoed by at least some people in the Washington legislature. And so I think the legal risk here was something that a lot of people did give some, it did give them some pause.
In our remaining time, I want to pivot to kind of some broader themes and potential implications associated with these bills. But often when you hear about religious liberty, a lot of it revolves around ability to worship, ability to follow one's conscience as it's been informed by your religious beliefs. I mean, I was trying to think of other examples. The only ones of late that came to mind during the COVID pandemic, the anointing of the sick came up in discussions because some priests were prevented from going into hospitals or long-term care homes to administer the sacrament of anointing of the sick. And then similarly, marriage, the legalization of same-sex marriage in a lot of countries, but even where that has been done, there are protections afforded for denominations, for ministers who choose not to solemnize or celebrate those rites within their liturgical practices. So it seems to me those elements of worship and practice are a little more at the forefront of these debates. And reconciliation, confession is usually not in the limelight in the same way. What do you make of all that and how confession kind of came into the spotlight here?
That's a good question. Thank you. I'll start with marriage. With all the fears that have come about through the legalization of same-sex marriage, there, you know, some people have said, you know, are priests going to be forced by law? And that has been an easy answer for me and for other religious liberty scholars and advocates to say, no. The if there's anything that the government can't do, at the core of this is tell a church who the church has to baptize, who the church has to marry. So the church still gets to decide who qualifies for its sacraments. And so I think that is a really important line. But as you mentioned with COVID, the some governments came awfully close and some even crossed the line in trying to, and this goes beyond whether or not you could have church services, but even how church services were administered. There were efforts to that really got awfully close to saying what is and what isn't necessary for a religious service. So is it necessary to give someone communion on the tongue? You know, for so for a public health order to say that communion in the hand is sufficient. And so getting into the way that that sacraments are performed, that is really getting into the interior matters of a religious community. In the early days of the pandemic, there was a lot more slack given to government, or a lot more slack that government took in doing that. But as time went on, I think bishops and priests became more confident, and then courts came into with more confidence as well to say that there are really important lines being drawn here. And I think your analogy is apt. First of all, the Catholic Church does recognize all of its sacraments, including the sacrament of reconciliation, as an act of worship. And I think it was the Bishop of Vermont that emphasized that in his remarks, that this is affecting my worship. And for government to say that confidentiality is not essential to the sacrament of penance is just as arresting. It should be just as arresting for us to say you don't really need wheat and you don't need wine in order to have communion, that you don't need water in order to baptize someone.
Right.
And it's important for the church to push back and say, that's not your call. You're not the one that determines that, that it is the church and it is the church's right to determine what is necessary for its own sacraments. And so I think it has been interesting in this public debate over these bills to talk about and to focus on the sacrament of penance. In fact, the first major section in the public comments that I submitted was an overview of the sacrament, because it is mysterious. And, you know, maybe people only know it from watching mob movies or from watching, you know, some sitcom. And so say, let's slow down. And I had a YouTube video of Father Mike sort of doing a walkthrough of the penance, but explaining practically what it looks like, how long it takes, what's involved, talking about the canon law, to try to kind of like do a little field trip with legislatures and sort of said, here's what we're talking about. Let's try to make it a little bit more accessible, and a little bit less scary, a little bit less foreign to you, to understand what it is and what it isn't. And this is a balance. I think this is also an important subject, is that the church itself and those of us as religious liberty advocates have to advocate for religious liberty, but at the same time, try to make publicly accessible arguments that show why the church is doing its best to be a good citizen, that the church is interested in justice. I don't like, it really makes me uncomfortable when there are religious liberty arguments that will just say, you can't do this. This is a black box. Stay away. End of story.
All right.
That is dissatisfying. It's dissatisfactory to me. And I can understand why it would be dissatisfying to legislators to be told, you know, whether or not there's a big problem here, you just have to stay out and that's it. Go away. If that's the argument that has to be made in a given context, then maybe there are some instances in which that's the best we can do. But by and large, we ought to do everything we can to help bring people along and help them appreciate that the Catholic Church is doing its honest best to be a good citizen, as well as trying to carry out its mission with integrity.
So in that spirit, I was going to ask you, these different measures, Washington, Vermont, Delaware, and perhaps even the other ones, Kansas and Utah, did you see merit in anything they were trying to accomplish? Did you see merit in any of the provisions? Was there some good or perhaps some good-spirited motive that you could acknowledge or speak to?
Well, absolutely. And as I began in my public comments, particularly in Washington State, where one of the aspects of the bill was to make clergy mandatory reporters, is to say that the Catholic Church and the bishops that were that I was representing in those instances care a lot about child safety, and they care a lot about justice. And it's a good thing that the legislator is focused on this issue. And the legislator ought to do everything it can to protect children and to bring perpetrators to justice. Those are all really good things. And it's important for us to start out presuming goodwill in all of our conversations. And that's why that I began with a lot of practical explanation and practical issues. You know, I didn't jump right into why this is unconstitutional. I want them to understand why the bill is, I believe, misunderstands the nature of the problem. And so to say, you know, first of all, priests aren't going to do it. But perhaps even more persuasively, like there really actually isn't a problem here. This really broad sense that everyone knows the Catholic Church has a problem with child sex abuse. It's like, well, it's actually a lot more complicated than that. Let's actually go into the reports. What are the numbers in the past 20 years? Beyond that, where are those cases happening? How are these cases discovered and then brought to public authorities? How is justice, has the seal of the confession actually been a practical problem impeding justice in these instances? And if it isn't that in itself, you know, why do we even have to get to the constitutional part of it? Why would you want to do something that doesn't actually address the problem that you're trying to solve? And so I want to lead with those, that the Catholic Church does care. It has been recognized as taking a lot of important steps in this area. And it wants to cooperate however it can. We talked about how priests would like to invite people to come outside the confessional to continue conversations in the context in which they can be an active participant in bringing about justice in society. I think part of this too, Patrick, is I think it's important for the church and for society at large to recognize that government is an important place, but it's not the only place that justice happens. So for those of us as parents, we do not simply say, well, if you think you are wrong, then go to the cops. We deal with justice in-house. And the church has to do the same thing. And so each of us has our own obligations to try to bring about justice. Sometimes that involves in bringing public authorities into the conversation. Most of the time it doesn't. But it is to affirm that the Catholic Church wants to bring about justice for its own reasons, not simply because there might be civil liability if it doesn't, but the Catholic Church on its own terms cares about justice. And so the Catholic Church does want to do the right thing and is going to try to do the right thing wherever it can. For a lot of reasons, it's hard for people who are secular to appreciate the Catholic Church is doing its best in a lot of these areas, that there's unfortunately a lot of reasons why people are cynical in our society. And that's something that I pay attention to and care about a lot. But in this instance, I was grateful that I had a lot of data to bring to bear, mm-hmm. and that the Catholic Church, by all accounts, is being a good actor in these areas. And so that's an important thing that I want to convey.
Just a couple of other questions. I mean, you live and breathe the religious liberty battles and religious liberty issues. And certainly, as I mentioned earlier, usually when these issues are percolating to the surface, it's for something, you know, something that grabs headlines like nothing else can. You know, the contraceptive mandate from the Department of, or excuse me, from Health and Human Services. The coach who wants to pray on the field with his team in a public school. You know, Christian doctors having to refer patients for euthanasia or having to learn how to do an abortion in order to get a license. You know, these are often where our mind goes to when we think of religious liberty issues being at risk or engaged. I know this is a very squishy type of question, but what we're talking about now in terms of these three bills and the risk they pose to the seal of confession, where would you kind of put them on a ladder of, or an index of religious liberty, of risk to religious liberty? I mean, is this not to put too fine a point on it? I mean, is this towards the top of that type of scale?
I'd say not, mostly because I think this is such an easy legal case. So I think it's an important thing to meet head on. But part of me, so I've been actively involved in all three of these states in trying to get these bills defeated. But there's been part of me all along that sort of says, you know, maybe it'd be better for one of them just to pass it. Let's just go ahead and have the legal argument. You know, instead of listening to me argue as to why these bills are unconstitutional, let's just go ahead and pass one. Let's go ahead and have the lawsuit. I'm confident we'll win. And then we can put a nail in that coffin and move on to another issue. So I think from that perspective, it doesn't scare me that much. I think the broader concern is what we see in this issue and in a lot of others is that there is a diversion in society between what certain groups of people think is important in terms of priorities. There is a increasing cynicism and a lack of respect for the way that the Catholic Church or other religious groups come to their own conclusions about how things ought to be done. And there is less and less patience for religious groups being able to do things that are seen as contrary to the public good. And so I see in these bills a part of these broader themes that deeply concern me, that whether it's on issues of gay rights, whether it's transgender rights, contraception, all these sorts of issues, there is a lot of distrust for religious groups and a lot of impatience for religious groups being able to operate by a different set of rules. There is a lot of talk, there has been the last few years, about calling religious liberty, putting it in scare quotes, saying that it is an excuse to discriminate. And so that concerns me a great deal, that sometimes the way these arguments go is to say, all right, we're going to cede or we will establish as a general principle that this is what justice requires. But then what we end up is saying that religious groups for some constitutional reason get to depart from that and get to do something that is contrary to the public good. And we can't stop them because of the First Amendment, but it's really frustrating and it's really dumb. And that's the way that a lot of people treat religious liberty. And that is hugely problematic for me, first of all, because I think it's inaccurate. And secondly, because I think in the long term, that attitude will tend to erode religious liberty. Our judges are practical. Our people, we're a practical people. And I think the law is sometimes like water coming down a stream that, you know, if there's a stone in the middle, the water's going to find a way around it. that over time, if people are convinced that religious liberty is a bad thing, that the Catholic Church is a bad actor in society or any other religious group, they're going to keep hammering away and trying to find ways to get around a legal impediment. So in the long term, arguing cases that simply say, look, the First Amendment's on our side, that's it, end of story, we're done, I think is a bad long-term strategy. And in my work in private practice with clients and in my work at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, I really want to strive to find ways to push beyond that argument and to break through and to help show society that religious groups and religious liberty are positive things.
Final question for the folks listening today. What can they do to support that effort and to support the strategies that you would see as effective?
I'd say for people in their individual communities, when religious liberty questions come up, listen for them, and to the extent that you participate, look for ways to communicate not only the negative side, but also the positive side of religious liberty. So not only that government can't stop us, but that it's good to have different sorts of groups that are each pushing for positive goods in their own society, and why the freedom of conscience for people who are sincerely pursuing the good is a good thing, and that people ought to be able to pursue the good according to their own lights. That's at the core of religious liberty.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you for your time today. I wish you all the best in continuing to fight the good fight, whether it's these particular measures in these particular states or the other waves that crash against the boat of religious liberty in our public domain and public discourse. Really appreciate your time today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for tuning in. If you're enjoying Crown and Crozier, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd be grateful if you could help us reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. Also, we'd love to hear from you. Check out our website at crownandcrozier.com or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. We're sincerely grateful for your support, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship.